story. Like my story.
No, not your story. A story.
I don't think I know any stories.
You don't know any stories?
No.
All right, I'll tell you a story.
That's the plan. That's what we're doing.
Sounds great. Hopefully, I have good answers for these questions I haven't seen.
I mean, they're real general and they're subjective, and we're just flying by the seat of our pants. I don't like, I can't listen to 6-hour podcasts, which seem to be the new.
Unless you're trucking or something.
Who has I don't know, man. I don't know. Yeah, unless, and even if you do have a long drive, like, I don't know. I can't focus on something that long when I'm listening anyway. But yeah, man. So the question that we've kind of been starting out with is why are stories important? You know, why are they important to you? Why are they important to us?
Yeah, what a good question. I think Joan Didion had the best answer. He probably knew that was coming, but like, it, stories are how you make sense of the world around you. It's how you understand other people's perspectives. It's how you, make sense of your own experiences. You kind of, whether you want to or not, your brain immediately starts shaping whatever you've experienced into some sort of narrative or story. Whether you write that down or share it in some way, you know, is irrelevant. I think we just all make everything into a story.
What's your interpretation of that passage that you're talking about? We can drop a link to it, I'm sure, somewhere.
Let's see.
Or maybe I'll just
pull it up.
It's
great. I mean, like, the best part of that is like the sermon and the suicide. I think, because suicide's like such a taboo topic, but also like, if you're, you know, on the periphery of one, like, it impacts you significantly, and it seems so, like, regardless of how you feel, like, religiously or whatever, like, there's something about suicide that is unnatural, I think, but maybe you could also argue natural, but there's like some sort of significance to it, and we try really hard to kind of weave a story around it. So yeah, if we didn't have stories, then like, there's no way to make sense of something as difficult as suicide.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people would argue that it's not natural, I think.
I would argue it's not natural.
They're, you know, the world being contrary, and then there's other people who are going to argue that it is. But we can jump into that thing I was talking to you about the other day too, about, there's some, in the stories that you tell in Double Knot, there's a bunch of heavy content, and it's not a beat you over the head book, but like, there's definitely, it leaves you with like a lot to chew on, which is crazy also, because it's also a book that you can read in a day. And I don't know, that was what I was thinking when I finished it the first time, was like, I don't know that I can recall the last time I've like read a book in a day, like, with ease, and still like was thinking about it the whole time. Usually when it's a book like that's that like brief and to the point about everything, like, it's not that heavy, and it's not, you know.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that was intentional, and I think that's what took the most time and the most hard work on my part, was like, I really wanted to distill it down into something that, like, I trimmed all the fat off of. There's no parts, or the goal was, there's no parts that kind of drag on, or the reader starts to slow down and maybe takes a break. I wanted it to move quickly, but I wanted it to pack a punch. So it makes me happy to hear you say that.
Yeah. I mean, the one that I'm talking about, the one that stands out to me is Harden Up, which, you know, we had ran previously, and it just like guts me every time. And when I was skimming through, I was like going through my notes the other day, because we've been trying to do this podcast for like 2-3 weeks now, and one of the notes I had made was about the contradiction, or at least like the opposing views that you have of suicide and veteran suicide, specifically like regarding, you know, people that we know. And then like I thought back to when I was editing Rock Eater by Mason Rodrigue and how he has a poem called Black Bracelets. And in Black Bracelets, like he talks about, you know, suicide in reference to Black Bracelets, which is something you also directly refer to in Harden Up, about like how there's been a shift in the culture.
Yeah, that one. Well, first, I got to say, me and Mason are close friends. So like to someone who doesn't know either of us, it might seem like his poem and this essay are kind of like on opposite ends of things.
Yeah.
But me and Mason are tight, and we've had conversations about this, and I think we're actually on the same page, although it might not seem like that at first. But
yeah,
what you're
I talked to him the other day too, just to, I was like, hey, I'm going to talk to Mac about this thing, and like it's, I don't want you to think it's a shot at you or your thoughts. And so I might have, you know, the same perspective and information that you got from him like over the summer. But
yeah, so I lost my train of thought here. Yeah, so in the essay, I make a reference to people wearing those black memorial bracelets for people who died via suicide. And before I get into like my opinion on this or anyone's, like, for someone who wears a memorial bracelet with a name of someone who died by suicide, like if that means something to them and it's important to them and it helps them cope with that loss or whatever, then like forget what I say or anyone else says. Like it doesn't matter. If that's for you, then like go for it. Who am I to tell you otherwise? But in my essay, I make a point that like these black bracelets went from a way to pay tribute to your friend or remind you to like stay grounded or keep a realistic perspective on things. They kind of evolved to like a status symbol, and it was something that like you wore if you'd been on a deployment because you'd lost someone, and it was a way to like show people in your uniform that like, you know, it's like a combat infantry badge or
a patch or a ribbon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it served the same purpose, and you know, kind of got diluted, and people would wear bracelets for people they didn't really feel strongly about. And then it kind of evolved further to like, well, I don't have anyone I know that died in action, but I do know people who killed themselves, so I'm going to wear this bracelet. Not everyone who wears one, that's not the case for everybody, but that certainly was happening. And so I make a reference to that in the essay. And then on the flip side, Mason wrote this beautiful poem about black bracelets, and I think it's about someone who died via suicide. So there is no criteria for when you can and can't wear one or what it should be, because originally they started as MIA bracelets in Vietnam. They had nothing to do with KIA. So our generation hijacked it and made it KIA bracelets. And then, you know, maybe not a whole generation, but younger guys started to make it about suicide. And somewhere in that slow shift, I kind of took issue with what was happening with those bracelets. And one of the essays touches on that briefly, I think is what you're getting at.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that it's going to necessarily like, evoke like a negative reaction from anyone, just because it's such a solid, you can't even really call it an argument, you know. It's just you coming at everybody with your perspective and that you have formed over time. And I think Mason mentions it a couple times, and like what made me think about it was because I think he mentions it in another poem too, but like how it really became a rite of passage, very much like, you know, knowing what a fucking rip it tastes like, or you know, any number or a TBI or hearing loss or any number of things that come with combat deployments, or just having the things that your seniors have. And this is what you want. You know, when you're a kid, you want to do whatever your parents do. When you're young enough anyway, like you want to do what your parents do just because they do it. Like my dad was an engineer and worked in a cubicle. And like, there's nothing cool about working in a cubicle, but like, I thought working in a cubicle was cool. I also thought like having a workbench in the garage was cool. There are things like that like are not necessarily like super glamorous that like still just look super cool because of the people who are raising you. And like, and that's kind of what I was thinking about is like that it became such a rite of passage, but then the shift into suicide deaths also was just like super interesting to me, because then it's like, all right, well, that's a really dangerous rite of passage. And then that like leads into, with less combat deaths and more suicide deaths, then like, is this where we're at now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like when you're the new guy at a unit, you look up to the guys who've been there and done that, and they've all got the bracelets, and you want to be just like them. You don't necessarily want dead friends, but like you want to have been there and done the thing.
Yeah.
But then it took a shift, and the bracelets kind of were like, hey, whatever you want to put on there, if you justify it to yourself, okay. And like, no one's going to question you about it because it's this very sensitive thing. It's a dead person's name on your wrist. Like, who are you to tell them they can't wear it?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what the essay tiptoes around, without trying to tell specific people, you know, you can't wear this or you can or whatever. That's not the point.
Yeah. Well, it's a good one. I mean, it may be one of my favorite. I actually don't know that I have a favorite. I think this is like the first time, like Didion's like collections of essays, I definitely like have favorites and I have like less favorites.
Yeah.
And this is a collection of essays where like I really enjoy it as a unit and like can't imagine it. Like, it's not missing anything. It doesn't have too much of anything. It's got a good balance of like, it's all about the war, but it's not all about blood and guts and, you know.
Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that. We were talking recently about, you know, publishing one of the essays in another publication as a standalone.
Yeah.
And I think I'm really excited about that just because getting the word out and getting people to read it, I'm excited for. But part of me is hesitant because I do think, even though it is 7 standalone essays, there's a reason they're all together in the same book. I think they complement each other, and there's one story from essay 1 to essay 7. So if you just read one, I think it can stand alone, but yeah, they definitely work better as one single book.
How did you determine that 7 was it? And like, I mean, cause you took some from things that you had previously published and reworked some things.
Yeah.
You know, one of which was like a fictional short story that we starved everyone into perfecting in Maine.
No one else felt like they were starving except for Tom. But
I was starving for the record.
So I didn't pick 7 as like, I need 7 a specific number because for whatever reason that number works. I had a certain amount of things I wanted to say. And as they started to like take shape, by the time I hit number 7, I was like, that's it. You know, I've got everything I wanted to hit is in here. And an 8th essay would be too much, and 6 would be too short. 7 was right where I wanted it to be.
Did you go over it? Like, and like, how did you make sure, like, after you had the 7 and went, you know, like, I mean, looking at the final manuscript, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I say this in the intro, but I had originally written like a full manuscript, a memoir that was, I forget how many words I say in the intro, but like a full size book. And it just felt too bloated. Like, it had everything I wanted to say in it, but it also had just other stuff. And so I wanted to distill that down into exactly what I wanted to say and nothing else. So like, yes, it is a war story, like you said, but it doesn't beat you over the head with blood and guts because one, I thought that would be boring. Like, only you can only describe a firefight so many times before it's like, yeah, we get it. Like, okay,
yeah.
You're reloading and you're moving and it's loud or whatever. But the other, so like, one, it was boring for me. And I was like, if it's boring for me and I lived it, it's going to be boring for the reader. So mm-hmm. Taking it out. And the other part is like, if I had filled a book full, I was talking to Plunkett about this on the Lit of War podcast, but like, if I had filled it with like every firefight or exciting thing I ever participated in, like a highlight reel of sexy stuff, like it would take any cool thing I'd been a part of to fill a whole book. And that would have given the wrong impression of like, oh, it was nothing but firefights and IEDs. Like, no,
yeah.
like when you look at the big picture, like wasn't in that many firefights, you know, wasn't in that many, you know, IED attacks or whatever. I would have had to put every single one in, and that gave a false impression. And I really wanted it to be an honest representation of what that time period for that job was in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I start the book off with an essay where I'm standing post. Arguably the most boring, least sexy thing you do in the military, but I don't think the essay is boring, but it's a more accurate representation of
it was selling it real good.
Yeah. It's a more accurate book. Representation.
Yeah. You'll have to get Mason to do some promos with his K-bar.
Yeah.
I immediately thought, you know, in that regard, like in the lack of direct combat experiences in it, I thought a lot about In Pharaoh's Army and how like Tobias Wolff like probably talks about like two actual engagements maybe, and like I think really like when you talk about like a firefight in Vietnam, like he probably talks about one
right.
And it's like it's just super brief but he talks about a lot of things. He talks about like difficulties, you know, reintegrating and doing like asshole things and like a lot of moral injury stuff that, you know, before we even knew what moral injury was. And
the other thing is like, you know, I couldn't tell you like a number of like how many ambushes I was in or whatever. Like they all kind of blend into one like vague memory together. And the things that really stand out in my mind. Yeah, the things that stand out in my mind are the things in the book. Like there's an essay about recovering the body of a dead soldier who died before we ever got to that battlefield. And I think about that way more than I think about, you know, a random fight here or a random, event. So those are the things I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Well, what, I mean, this leads into, you know, the second of, you know, two out of three questions. And then you're fucked. Then that's it. But what's your favorite part of a story? Like
favorite part of a
story. However you want it. Favorite
general?
Part of a story. Yeah.
Oh man, this is tough. There's usually a part in a story where it hooks you. Like sometimes it's the first sentence. Sometimes you know you're halfway there, and it might be great writing or great storytelling, and so you're invested, but then there's a moment where you're like, okay, I'm definitely seeing this through to the end because I have to know how this plays out, or I have to know what the author is going for. Whenever I am conscious of I've just hit that moment, I get super jazzed about it.
Man, that's a great answer. I like when I asked Jeremiah too, I like that, like I asked the question and like I could be talking about like elements of a story or like a specific story that you've heard. And like, I like this part where like, you know, the dude gets the chick, like, but like no one ever even questions it. Like they immediately know, you know, they just interpret it however and just run with it.
What I really like about that moment I'm trying to describe is that it's different through every single storyteller or writer, you know, in our case. Some people hook you in the beginning, some people don't really give you that gotta finish moment until you're pretty much at the climax, but it's exciting when I'm like reading a new author I haven't read before and I'm like, oh, this is it, this is the moment.
I think a lot of people are like that with reading and then movies too. Like, anytime I actually stopped asking Jericho, anything about movies ever, like, you know, as far as like, hey, did you see this? Because he just like talks, he's like, you really, like slow, dull movies, huh? Like, I don't know. I grew up with like indie kids. So what do you want? But I think reading is the same too, that like, I mean, if somebody's got some like solid like one-liners, but the voice, you know, the voice has to be genuine. And that's the cool thing, you know, back to like the, you know, combat versus everything else in between, in Double Knot, you can tell like the whole war story with like way more than firefights and even, you know, whatever.
Because that's one tiny part of a war
story.
right?
Yeah.
Like if it's just the action, you know, just the explosions or whatever, then that's a fraction of the real war story. So
yeah,
they're in there because they're necessary, but it's not a whole book of that because who wants
all the in between? Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy, man. The last essay, is particularly gripping for like, just because it like, I feel like it closes out the collection so well. And I don't want to give anything away for anybody. It's not, you know, it's your story. So it's not like there's like a surprise ending or anything. But it definitely like, I think there's no better way, other than like you going on to write about it. Like there's, you know, there's no better way for you to close out like your story and like, you know, all of our story in a way.
Thanks. The first six essays were pretty much completed. There were a few minor edits to be made when I sat down to begin writing the seventh essay. And I knew when I had that story in my head, I was like, this is it. This is the end of the book. I got to write this one. And I wrote it. And that one was one of the easiest ones to write. It just came out really cleanly. Some of the other ones took a lot of reworking. And one specifically, it's titled Going Cigaretting. And yeah, from start to finish, I knew what I wanted to do, wrote it. And when the first draft was done, I was like, okay, this is not going to take long to edit because it's what I want. And I also felt like it closed the whole book out nicely. I was like, there's nothing to add to this at that point. And I hope that the reader feels that way too. When they get to that last essay, it feels like a satisfying conclusion.
Dude, it's just so, the collection's just so like balanced. Like it's so, you know, there's a lot to it, and they are different stories for sure, all with, you know, common themes and stuff, but it is, you know, it's balanced, it's layered like a cigar. Except your mouth doesn't taste like shit the next day for, you know, a week straight.
Yeah.
But what, the one thing I've been saying, to people when they're like, oh man, you must be so excited. And like, we've been friends, now for a while. And, you know, before we were like actual friends, like knew about each other and kind of coexisted, yeah, really well. And, you know, just given like the lack of like what we were doing, you know, veterans and books and writing and stuff on social media. But like, you're a dude at the end of the day, like you're a dude who's been writing about other people's books for a really long time. Like, and now you've been writing professionally for a couple of years. But like, when I think about like, you know, you're a dude who writes about other people's books, like, is that cool? Like, is it, you know, did you know that you were going to write a book? Were there doubts? Like,
No, I always knew I wanted to write a book, not just a book, books. Like, that's what I want to do from here on out. I wrote small reviews like for social media posts online, and I made a point to only review stuff that I had given like enough time to, that I read and didn't rush or anything. And also I made a point to not write negative reviews, because if I don't like something, I didn't feel like, there's enough people on the internet just trashing people's hard work or art, you know, and I was like, they don't need one more voice telling them it's bad. So like, I'm just going to share stuff that I think is awesome to other people that I think would benefit from it. And that, you know, evolved. And then I started writing professionally in 2020 for Coffee or Die magazine. And I've always been happy to write reviews for other people because it's fun, but also because it's like how I, you know, learned actual writing skills, not just.
Yeah, you've been getting the reps.
Like, you know, anyone can pick up a pen and write on the page. And I encourage everyone to do that. But it did take me working every day with a team of good writers and good editors to really get to the point where I felt like I could write what I wanted to say. I could put what was in my head onto a page and feel good about it and think it's worthy of someone else's time to read it. So yeah, it's kind of been a nice journey to get to this point. I'm glad I didn't rush the book and just, you know, write what I was feeling, you know, 10 years ago and rushed to try and find a publisher to put it out there, because I wouldn't be satisfied with it. But this book, I'm very proud of and satisfied with how it turned out.
Did any of the essays from Double Knot come from like Pipes and Pages days when before you were writing for Coffee or Die?
No. I mean, some of the events in the book I had written about, but not really for an audience, just for myself. And then those, you know, I expanded on for this manuscript that I ended up trashing. So no, not directly, but yeah, some of the events I've written about in different ways before.
Yeah.
In the second essay, Harden Up, which we already talked about, I actually mentioned an article I wrote for Dead Reckoning way back when. So that was an interesting, that was a difficult one to write, but I think an interesting circle. And even more difficult because I'm talking about a friend of mine who's also a friend of yours. And I'm not always saying the most flattering stuff. So I was very nervous to put that one out there, but it's one that I feel strongly about. So that's why it's in there.
It's necessary. That's, you know, that's the one that we, I think we keep coming back to, but, it hits on important subjects and it says something like, dying doesn't make you a hero. Dying doesn't make you a good person. And like those things are tough pills to swallow for a lot of people, especially in like day and age where we're like, we're still reeling from, you know, the really shitty welcome home that Vietnam veterans got. And like now we're in this weird transitional phase that seems to continue to be transitional of thank you for your service. And like there are some people who are still trying to figure out, and then there are some people who are just indifferent, like, you know, say thank you or don't, or do whatever the fuck you want. And I think the book, I mean, that essay in particular, hits the nail on the head really well without even addressing that, you know, the thank you for your service stuff. But like, I don't know where I was going with that.
Yeah, it doesn't directly touch on the whole thank you for your service thing. My opinion on that is like, if someone says thank you for your service, say thanks and go about your day.
Yeah.
Appreciate the fact they took the time. Don't think too hard about like, oh, did they mean it? Is it flipping? Or like, well, who cares? They said thanks, say thanks back and move on with your day. But the essay is about more spicy topics, but I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. No, it's sweet. It's short and sweet, man. What's the most important part of your story?
Oh, what a question. As in, as in the book?
I mean, your story. Like I said about the last one, it's just, you know, how you interpret the question.
Man, I don't know. I guess how it impacts other people. Especially after, you know, becoming a father, that really changes your whole worldview, as you know. And so now my story is just, how are my kids going to read whatever you say my story is? That's more important to me than how I view my own story or anything like that. Just want to make sure I'm leaving a good impression and a good example for them.
Do you think this does that?
I think so. It's not always flattering, but it's honest. Yeah. And so it's honest and I think it's important. So it does that. I could, you know, write a book that is dishonest and just is very flattering or everything I wish a story would be. And, but I wouldn't be happy with that.
No, I think
you guys as the publisher would have read it and also not been happy with it. And
said, I mean,
we love you, but this is bullshit.
I can't imagine that you would write anything bad. And I think that's, it's apparent now, like that we, you know, you had a manuscript and you trashed it because it didn't do what you wanted it to do.
Which was hard to do.
I bet.
I put a lot of time and a lot of work into it. And so I went back and forth for like a year or so of like, do I just, you know, clean it up and send it off? And and finally I was like, no, this isn't what I want. So I'm going to put it down and start fresh.
I mean, I think we're seeing that a lot now too. And maybe also like the lack of people doing what you just said you did. Everyone wants to, and everyone should be able to tell their story, but like also there are skills needed to tell those stories. Otherwise, like, it's going to be lost, you know?
And the bottom line is, like, if you rush something or don't put the appropriate amount of time and work in, you won't be happy with it. And once it's out there, you can't take it back. So
yeah,
you don't want to be haunted by like a half-assed piece of work that you rush to the finish line, then don't do it. But put the time and the work in.
I mean, that's the thing, like 24 years of war, like we're going to continue to have more and more stories. And maybe there are some out there that, like, you know, you talked about a manuscript. Maybe nobody wrote their double knot. Maybe they trashed the manuscript and then didn't go back to it.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who have done that. I hope they do.
Yeah. Same. But it's, you know, in all these years of war, we're going to have so many varying experiences, and it's just going to continue to evolve. And so, it's been really cool to see you go from, a anonymous Instagram account, writing about other people's books, to like, a dude that we met in real life when we invited him to Maine, and he trusted us enough to get on a plane and get in a car with other dudes that he had never met in real life. And then, you know, all the way through like your professional writing career and like, and then on. And it's cool to see that evolution and you like really putting in the hard work of without going to school, you know, getting an MFA and like learning creative writing to do what you're doing and like and put this shit together.
Thanks. Yeah, I've been very fortunate, I think, just in, well, one, you know, it's so easy to trash social media because it's mostly just a pile of,
it's a dumpster fire.
Yeah, it's a dumpster fire. However, it is what you put into it and what you make of it. And so I started my Instagram page, Pipes and Pages, back in 2017, which is when you guys started Dead Reckoning. Mm-hmm. And it and we didn't have any mutual friends that I know of, but just by doing the same, appreciating the same stuff, you know, we crossed paths, and without any kind of foresight into like, oh, one day, you know, we'll be a very successful, you know, publishing house, and this person's going to be a writer who's going to give us a manuscript that we're going to like and publish. Like, there was just like, hey, you guys are good people and I want to associate with you guys. And so social media has done that for a lot of the relationships I have now. And it's how I, you know, met the right people to get that professional writing job. And so shameless plug, I guess, for social media. It is what you make it. So it can be horrible. Your algorithm will really make you feel like a terrible person if you let it. But
yeah,
you just seek out positive things and you put positive things out there, then it can be a force for good, I guess.
Yeah, I've done a lot more of the, you know, Tyler and I have very much like equally shared the responsibility and then taken on each other's loads like at different times, like throughout this. And now we have Jessica doing like all the education stuff, which is like phenomenal too, because she's an actual educator and can do those things. But like, you know, Tyler traditionally like pushed projects across the finish line. I also did like a lot more outreach stuff than he ever really enjoyed doing when it came to like social media and like staying up on different things. And this was like also, you know, for the beginning of Dead Reckoning, like was when you could actually like work the algorithms like with Instagram and Facebook and stuff. So I am thankful that like we existed at a time, and I feel like that about a lot of things. Like I've said to my friend Ian, we had a conversation one day about like how if we would all be in jail if cell phones were what they are now when we were growing up, because there'd be video evidence of everything, every assault and every whatever criminal act. Like toast. We'd be done under the jail. So being able to like recognize that, like, man, we got in like when it was okay, and even though it was, I mean, social media has been toxic like on every platform for however long, and now we can say like, cool, we built these friendship, we got something positive out of it, and you know, discovered this person, and I'm still doing it. I found this cool ass artist who was an old Second Bat guy. It's called his account is like Roids and Coke. Yeah, dude, look him up. But he does a lot of art surrounding like jiu-jitsu. So he does like a lot of sketches of rolling and stuff like actual sketch journals. Super cool account. And then when I reached out to him, because I was at Lewis, I wasn't a ranger, but I was at Lewis from 08 to 11. And I was like, when were you there? And he was like, oh, and he was there like in the 90s. So just, you know, this old dude like does art, figured out social media, and is like just doing his thing. You know, there's still like, it's just like when people say there's no good rap anymore, I'm like, you aren't listening to the right music, or no good anything anymore, no good hardcore, no good punk rock. Like you're just not in the right space, and I probably can't help you, but I mean, that's the same thing. Like, you know, if you're looking hard enough, then you'll find what you're looking for.
Yeah, for sure. And like one day, the only social media I have is Instagram, and one day it'll go away, and you know, whatever. But I've got real relationships now that only exist because Instagram allowed us to connect in the first place.
Who, what would you do if it all went away? Like, are you an archivist? Like, do you have?
No, it would all be gone. I don't like
everything's
every,
gone.
Every picture of it would all be trashed, and I would be pissed for a little, and then be like, well, I guess I'll go for a walk.
All right, you'll have to talk to Mason, because it was almost the case for him for the Dead Gunner account. It was a rough summer.
Yeah. I would be disappointed for sure, because of the connections and because of, you know, I put a lot of time into it, but it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. I think I would be more pissed if it were like Spotify. Cause at this point I've like gotten rid of, I'm a super analog dude, but like all my CDs were gone before they ended up gone like while I was in the army.
Spotify would hurt. That would
probably be the worst. I have vinyl, but not everything on vinyl, you know, and like, and the way that we live today too, like I turn music on my phone, like while I'm working at the Desert House and stuff. That would be a hit. But everything else. And also there's just so much, I don't think anything can like go away, and I don't think they're going to make anybody like pay, and it'll just be like, it'll creep in, you know, and be like, oh, it's going to be a dollar more. for the rest of your life every year. Like, they, I mean, they're so smart, dude.
Smarter than us.
That kind of wealth is something I would wish upon myself for sure. To be smart but also to do like genuine shit. And I think that's the cool thing. Like, there have been like people who were like, oh, you guys gotta charge more for the course. And I'm like, yeah, but like then they won't be available to people. So Tyler and I probably shouldn't say this on the podcast, but Tyler and I aren't like probably like very like great businessmen. Like, we're not fucking sharks.
You guys are authentic and have been since 2017 when you started. And that's why the authors that you've attracted, the work that you guys have put out is all stuff that's incredible and wouldn't exist elsewhere. And anyone who's read any of the books you guys have put out can sense that immediately. And that's what's so awesome about you guys. If you guys are like better businessmen, you could have had more followers or sold more of this or that, but like brand would have diluted and like the work would have sucked. And every single book you guys have put out has been awesome, and you guys should be really proud of. And that's way more important than just, you know, oh, maybe we could charge more for this class and make it.
Yeah.
Spending money.
Well, thank you. I really like, speaking of classes, we got to get you, teaching, sir.
Well, that's what I'm doing, for a living now. So happy to do it for you guys.
Do it for, more of a profit share with us. Cause, I understand how much educators don't get paid. But it's better than bartending, bro. Good job. You know, it's
pay wise. I don't know. Bartending.
No, not better pay wise. I didn't say that, but.
Yeah, as far as satisfaction goes, though, it's much more rewarding to teach young people than to pour drinks.
The stories are probably on par too, right? You know, like the stories that come from both the jobs.
Yeah, like? Yeah. Just different kinds of stories, but for sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
I got one of those classic, like kids, you know, narrative, like pictorial, whatever you want to call them, like from my daughter's class today. And it was like, you know, what's your worst fear? And like her worst fear is goats. And
dude, that's amazing. Cause I hate goats and people,
well,
they are terrifying.
When she was still in diapers, she was at a mini golf course, where they, had like little baby goats, like running all over the place, which I think sounds rad, but she was like still in diapers, bent over and got like headbutted in the butt. And so it, like, she told the story about that. And I'm like, oh,
she's got a real reason. She's got to be ashamed of. I've had no bad interactions with goats. I just see
them. Don't like them.
I'm like, hell no.
Their eyes are pre Afghanistan.
I definitely,
has this always been,
you know, now you say that, no, it was definitely a post Afghanistan thing, but also did not have a bad interaction with a goat in Afghanistan. They were everywhere, but like, it's not like one headbutted me or anything. I think that was the first time I was close to them. And I was like, these animals are fucked. I don't like them at all.
Yeah. It's probably,
also, like, have you seen The Witch with Black Phillip? Because,
the dude who wrote and directed that, I went to school with,
no way.
Yeah.
He did family, The Northman and The Lighthouse. And
yep. Yeah, Rob Eggers, he married Allie Shaker, who was in my class. But his family, the Eggers, did like all kind of, they had like a theater group and stuff, and had a whole like home setup and stuff. They were like that art family.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah, well, dude, tell everybody anything else that you think that they should know about the book, except for when it's coming out, because they have to go to the website.
Don't announce when it comes out.
I'm not going to.
It comes out soon, so don't forget about it. But it is
up for pre-order.
It is up for pre-order now. It's 7 essays. The War in Afghanistan is the through line, so it is a war book. However, it is not a traditional war memoir in the sense that it isn't just a chronological telling of combat. There's much bigger issues that I address, and you should buy it. It's funny. It's very serious at times. I think it'll move you. And whether you served, didn't serve, served in a combat role or a support role, or you know nobody in your life that's ever served in the military, this book is still for you, and you will get a lot out of it. So please support the arts and grab a copy.
I think you'll enjoy it. Solid, man. You're so much better at that than I ever have been. Tyler, I always just point at Tyler when people tell us to do the elevator pitch.
Well, if Tyler was here, I'd probably point to him, but
I could talk for, yeah, Tyler probably could even say it even better than you.
Yeah,
I think he loves this book more than you do, for sure. He's
a charming fella.
Yeah, but also I think everybody that reads it like loves it more than the last person too. So we haven't heard one negative thing. I mean, we sent out just a chock load of ARCs, and like the reception has been so good.
It's been very flattering. All the feedback I've gotten has been very positive, and I didn't just send it to, you know, my best friends who'd be like, this is great,
you know,
like handed them some dribble. Like I sent it to people I knew would be, who disagreed strongly about some of the things I said. I sent it to people that have been very critical of my writing in the past. And I've been so pleasantly surprised because all the feedback has been very positive.
Yeah, dude.
So that's calming the nerves a little bit. I'm really excited to hear what people think once it's out in the wild.
I think it's going to be well received. And you know, now we're just trying to figure out how to get it into like everyone's hands and make everyone read it. Cause I think it has the potential to do that very much like Didion, you know, Didion resonating with dudes like us, like doesn't necessarily make sense. You know, like Jessica, like that night that we had dinner in Portsmouth, the first night in Maine, when Tom asked Jessica about her Didion like tote bag, she immediately like, you know, clenched her fist and like was ready to like fight a dude over, like she was like, wow, what's he gonna say about Didion? He's like, oh, I love her, like, you know, and they started talking about Didion. Like, it's not a, you know, it's not a normal thing. And I think this has the potential to do that for maybe the Didion crowd, you know, or the people.
I hope so. That
really,
thanks for saying that. That I hope so. That's been, you know, if one person loves it, nine people hate it, like that's fine. I'm proud of it regardless. But the goal was that, you know, this isn't just Marine grunts are going to pick it up and be like, yeah, this is what I experienced too. Like, I'm hoping that people who are totally foreign to this whole world and experience can resonate with it just on a human level. That's the goal. So some of my coworkers, for example, I teach English, and some of them I think will be pretty, I don't know, uncomfortable with some of the things I talk about. But the goal is that I can reach them with this book, and it doesn't turn them off of it just because it's, you know, got weapon nomenclature and shit like that that would normally make people's eyes glaze over.
Yeah, I don't think there's like a total absence of it, but I don't think it's like over, you know, it's not like cumbersome, like the,
yeah,
know,
no
acronyms and shit like that. But do you want someone to hate it? You want me to just say I hate it just so you have one?
Because maybe not publicly, but if you want to call me after this and tell me why it's so bad, that's fine. I do want
to
get that
be out. Able to, I'll make something up. Just toughen you up a little bit. Well, dude, is this your first? I don't know. You recorded with Lit of War the other day. Did you ever do podcasts before?
No. I got asked to do a lot of podcasts based on the Pipes and Pages Instagram account. Yeah. Over the years, and I always turned it down because, like, if you go to the page, there's no pictures of me. No, now Double Knot is on there, but it's the first time I've really promoted my own work, because the point was never I was never like, yes, it's anonymous, but like, you know, messaging people and stuff. It wasn't like I was hiding my identity. It was just the focus needs to be on other people's books that are awesome, that we can all celebrate together. So yeah, I avoided podcasts for a while because I didn't want the page to be, oh, that's Mac's page. It was, no, what's that cool page that has all the books where we can all get together? So no, I did record with Lit of War two nights ago, but yeah, other than that, this would be the first one.
Yeah, Plunk is killing that podcast, man. I love it. We tried to do the same thing. And it was like, it was a really cool experiment. Tyler and I ultimately like eventually had to like start showing faces. And then also like we couldn't avoid it when we started doing like in-person events and stuff and readings and workshops
and stuff. Well, and you guys were selling something. So at a point you can't just stay anonymous if you're selling something. Luckily with Python Pages, I wasn't selling anything, so it didn't matter whether I was on it or not. And me injecting myself into that thing I created did nothing for it. So
for April Fool's Day, you should do like a sweaty selfie video in your car.
Like a truck rant where I'm just
sitting. Yeah, like a truck rant.
Mad about politics or.
Oh, man. That is just a funny combo of words. Like when you're describing that thing and it's perfect.
I'll make sure the seatbelt's still on and I'm.
Yeah, trademark that. Sure. Super sweaty, though. Like you gotta, dump water on yourself if you need to, but genuine sweat for sure.
No cardio, just sweat from anger.
For April Fools, on Pipes and Pages, and then that'll be it.
Yeah, I would, except I'm going to wait till this book is on sale
before. I don't know, man. Everybody will know about it then. They'll be like, who is this little nerd with the really, like, real thick beard who looks like Yukon Cornelius? And why is he so mad in his truck? Yeah, his dog's cute. God. Ugh. Crazy. All right, man. Well, I'm going to cut this off before we start getting verbal diarrhea. But it was really good to hear you talk about the book. And which I think this is the first time we've talked like verbally, you know, not like just chucking emails back and forth and text and stuff since you told me you were sending me the manuscript. So it's great to hear you talk about it and like how passionate you are about all these and like what, you know, what they mean to you and what you hope they mean to other people.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate you having me on the podcast. And yeah, thanks for your guidance throughout the years and for taking a chance on this book. I'm really, really pleased with how it turned out. And I hope that people give it a read and that they're happy with it.
Shit, tell me a story right now. Go.
All right. Well, so it was real quiet.
Boom! What the fuck? You never know. That's the point.